491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 317, recorded on July 19th, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me, as always, on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And on the line from DC is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Rachel.
So we're going to be talking today about prison labor. Now, this is a huge topic that we could spend, you know, many episodes on and talk about all different kinds of states and what's going on in each state. We don't have time to do that. So we've made some selections on the historical background of this topic, as well as some specifics from the news, especially recently, or specific states that we wanted to highlight. This is something that I feel very strongly about and have been trying to raise attention on for a number of years now, both as a political candidate and now as an elected official. Locally. Obviously, I'm not really speaking in my capacity as an elected official today, per se, on this show, but I suppose on some level it's indivisible from me. But anyway, this is a thing that you could say, like, it's good to have, if we're going to have all these prisoners, then they should have something to do, et cetera, and maybe they'll get some skills and so on. But we're going to talk about why that argument doesn't quite hold up and why there are some ways of rethinking that in terms of how you would structure a morally just program for prisoners to work if you were to do that. But of course, the big thing that's hanging over all of this, as we'll talk about, is that very obviously having prison labor systems at all tends to incentivize, and often has in this country, bringing in more prisoners to be those prisoner laborers. So that's something to keep in mind as we're talking about this. So Rachel, there were a few things from the news or the recent past that we wanted to refresh people's memory on, re-jog people's minds on. So talk to me about those before we get into the history of this.
Okay. So I don't know how big of a wave it made, but at the end of December 2019, The Intercept published an article kind of breaking the news that the Bloomberg presidential campaign was using prisoners to phone bank. The campaign contracted a New Jersey-based call center company, Procom, which runs call centers in New Jersey and Oklahoma. Two of the call centers in Oklahoma are operated out of state prisons. And at least one of those two prisons, incarcerated people were contracted to make calls on behalf of the Bloomberg campaign. So people incarcerated at the Dr. Eddie Warrior Correctional Center, which is in a minimum security women's prison with a capacity of more than 900, were making calls to California on behalf of Bloomberg. The people were required to end their calls by disclosing that they were paid for by the Bloomberg campaign, but they did not have to disclose that they were calling from behind bars. A spokesperson for the Bloomberg campaign, Julie Woods, said, quote, "We didn't know about this, and we never would have allowed it if we had. We don't believe in this practice, and we've now ended our relationship with the subcontractor in question." John Scallon, who is a co-founder of Procom, said his company pays the Oklahoma minimum wage of $7.25 an hour to the Oklahoma Department of Corrections, which then pays the incarcerated people working in the call centers. The Department of Corrections website lists a maximum monthly wage for the incarcerated at $20 a month, but another policy document says there's a maximum pay of $27.09 per month. When asked if their total monthly earnings are capped at these levels, Scallon said incarcerated people who work for ProCom make far higher wages. And he said, quote, "I can tell you unequivocally that it is not us. Some of them are making that much every day." However, the Oklahoma Department of Corrections did not respond to multiple requests for comment to clarify the discrepancy, nor to answer questions about ProCom's arrangement with the Bloomberg campaign. So I think something that often gets missed in this is the fact that the prisoners aren't getting paid directly. They're getting paid by their state or federal Department of Corrections. So that money is going through a third party before it gets to them. So I think there's often a miscommunication on how much the prisoner actually gets. And I think the Department of Corrections gets to really skim a lot of that off. And prisoners often have to pay like overhead. They have to pay for things like transportation.
We're going to circle back to that at the end of the episode, or toward the end of the episode, as we talk about the history of this, because I think that is going to be important. Again, the vendor is paying $7.25 an hour, but the person is not getting $7.25 an hour and potentially is only getting a small fraction of that every month.
Right. And this is not the first time prison labor was used in a federal election. In 1994, the late Republican congressperson from Washington State, Jack Metcalf, also used prison labor to make campaign calls, and he was subsequently elected to Congress, where he served three terms. And I also wanted to highlight past episodes where we talked about this subject before. Back in 2018, on episodes 236 and 242, we discussed prison labor, especially in the context of the 2018 labor strike that occurred from August 21st to September 9th. It was organized by the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, or IWOC, and they had a list of 10 demands. One of the demands most pertinent to our discussion is they demanded an immediate end to prison slavery. All persons imprisoned in any place of detention under United States jurisdiction must be paid the prevailing wage in their state or territory for their labor. And as we saw, even if the vendor is paying that minimum wage, it doesn't always make it to the incarcerated people. So that is one of their big demands. Also, I just wanted to highlight really quickly another important demand, since it's 2020, an election year. They also demanded the voting rights of all confined citizens serving prison sentences, pretrial detainees, and so-called ex-felons. They demanded that their votes be counted and that they have representation. So I think while it's especially big in 2020, it's big every year, that they're demanding proper wages for their work, a chance to address grievances if they have unsafe working conditions or unsafe living conditions, and a voice in the election process as well. I did want to highlight that in Idaho, I did a quick look on the IDOC website, and in Idaho, prisoners get paid 10 cents per hour for low-skill work and up to 30 cents an hour for high-skill jobs. This is on prison facilities, at work camps, and CWCs, which is a community work center that is operated by the prison. Vocational work crews are working under a contract with a hiring agency. It says they're self-sufficient, which means that the crew generates enough revenue to pay for the supervising staff, offender incentive pay, and other costs associated with the operation of the crew, such as tools, vehicles, etc., but it doesn't actually specify a wage. And if an incarcerated people who are on work release or prison industry and enhancement programs, which is a federal program that allows inmates the opportunity to work in private industry in hard-to-fill positions, it says they do make at least minimum wage. However, offenders on work release pay IDOC over a third of their pay. They also pay fees to cover their transportation, laundry, etc. Offenders working in the prison industry enhancement program are also employees and paid at least minimum wage. but they pay over half of their gross pay back into the program. So that's something I just wanted to highlight locally in my state.
Mm-hmm. So Kelly and I are going to talk about the history of prison labor in the United States, which has had a number of significant evolutions and phases. We've set up sort of where we're at now, but we have to go back in time and look at some of the other ways that this has been done. Obviously, one that a lot of people are starting to be familiar with is around the 13th Amendment and the post-Civil War period. But even a lot of that, as I will talk about after Kelly talks about that, actually dates to before the Civil War, just that sort of enshrined it constitutionally, and there were obvious changes with the end of slavery that made a further evolution in that process. Today, of course, as we said, there are some differences that are pretty significant in that it's generally not, although we'll talk about the exceptions, generally not technically slave labor, prisoner labor, where you're forced to do whatever work and you get no money. That's a major change in most cases, though not all cases. But that, as Rachel has just highlighted, doesn't actually necessarily mean that they're getting paid like equitable wages. Kelly, why don't you start us off with some of the historical stuff, and then I will fill in some more as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Like Bill alluded to, there's been just an increasing national consciousness about, but just to remind everyone of their history lesson about the 13th Amendment, which you know, disallowed slavery in the United States. It has a specific, it specifically mentions allowing labor, sort of slave labor, in the context of the criminal justice system. And it reads, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. So documentaries like 13th and books like The New Jim Crow have really gone into a lot of detail about how slavery, which was disallowed by this amendment, was very quickly replaced by the labor of prisoners. The Atlantic did a piece a while back about state penitentiaries that are currently on the sites of former plantations, and the imagery of present day inmates sort of toiling in the fields is very alarming and looks just like slavery did, you know, a couple hundred years ago. In the Atlantic, they write, specifically, the proliferation of prison labor camps grew during the Reconstruction era following the Civil War, a time when Southern states established large prisons throughout the region that they quickly filled, primarily with Black men. Many of these prisons had very recently been slave plantations, Angola and the Mississippi State Penitentiary among them. Other prisons began convict leasing programs where, for a leasing fee, the state would lease out the labor of incarcerated workers as hired work crews. Convict leasing was cheaper than slavery since farm owners and companies did not have to worry at all about the health of their workers. So we can see very quickly how prison labor came to replace slave labor, pretty much without missing a beat, both in the South but throughout the United States.
So one thing that comes to mind as you're listening to what Kelly has just said about places like Angola State Penitentiary, so forth, and what I'm about to talk about, is that when we're having discussions today about concepts like prison reform or prison abolition, this is something that has been a hot topic in the United States and also the United Kingdom and Europe for the entire period of U.S. history. This is something that in the late 18th century, at the dawn of the United States, they were having conversations about what should prisons be like, what is the best for society, what is the best for the prisoners, etc. Unfortunately, they do not always come to the same conclusion, and you should be wary when you have discussions about prison reform or even prison abolition, because in many cases, the stuff we're about to talk about was instituted by prison abolitionists at various phases. They just thought that they were abolishing prisons as we know it or whatever and completely reconceptualizing them, which is true on some level, but doesn't really fix the actual moral injustice of the situation and the societal ill of it. So at some point, you know, we moved away from debtors' prisons and so forth. In the early 19th century, we get this phase of, I mean, this is big time proto-Nazi energy of like, work shall set you free. So the morally righteous thing to do is give work to the prisoners because, you know, idleness is the devil's playground and all that jazz. I mean, this is some very big time disturbed American Protestant energy in the thinking here. But in the first half of the 19th century, northern prisons hired out labor to farms and factories. This is called the contract labor system. This became the model that was followed by southern prisons after the Civil War when creating those famous black chain gangs that Kelly was just talking about and all the other 13th Amendment related things. But it is important to note two things about this. First of all, the reason that that provision is in the 13th Amendment is because at the time, the people who were writing it thought, yeah, you know what's great for prisoners and best for society to rehabilitate people is to force them to do work. So this idea of depriving people of their liberty and putting them into servitude as a punishment, explicitly enshrined in this new constitutional amendment, that was what, for some reason at the time, they thought was... or at least I should say some people thought was the way to go with what was best for the prisoners and best for society. The second thing to note, even in the post-Civil War period, despite this new attention that we have as a society on what happened in the South in this period, it's critical to note that the Northern contract labor system was worth $35 billion in 2012 dollars and represented 80% of all U.S. prison labor. So you can talk about how slavery was directly replaced in the South after the Civil War with these 13th Amendment provisions of prisoners becoming essentially slaves. But it is important to understand that this was not only already happening in the North, but continuing to happen for decades in the North on a very, very widespread basis. The North had created this essentially almost, from today's perspective, silent system of massive slavery, and the conditions were absolutely horrifying, which then prompts the second wave of we're going to rethink prisons completely as, you know, and totally reconceptualize prisons. The contract labor system would have absolutely brutal conditions, just like we were seeing in the South with recently freed slaves and people that, you know, the overseers turning into the prison chain gang overseers and so forth. We're seeing the same thing in the North already for decades preceding this, where, you know, either the prison guards would implement horrible conditions or they would literally outsource it to whatever company was contracting these prison labors. And you could do whatever you wanted with these prisoners. And if they died, well, who cares? Because they were prisoners. That was the attitude that was starting to be challenged beginning in the late 1860s. So I think probably, if I had to guess, I don't know this for sure, but I think a lot of the slavery abolitionists repiloted their attentions toward this prison labor issue after the Civil War. So prison abolition efforts beginning in the late 1860s to try to replace the abusive contract labor system led to the creation of production within the prison systems directly, although sometimes the outside businesses just installed factories inside the prisons. So this didn't really solve the problem either in that initial period of attempting to do more reforms because it just they would install the machinery inside the prison and then still be working people to death or beating them or whatever. That was obviously not the case in the standard workforce. Both indoor and outdoor prison labor, whether they're factory or farm labor, could be treated extremely severely compared to non-prison workers. If you were a non-prison worker, you could, even if you didn't have a whole lot of economic options at the time, you could still just walk off the job and quit if you needed to because the, you know, factory floor man was an absolute nightmare. And that is not the case if you were a prison worker. Prisoners were also routinely used to break strikes by new unions that were forming both before and after the Civil War by replacing the workforce of a factory entirely. Local union radicals in Tennessee actually freed prisoners during the so-called Coal Creek War, specifically to try to prevent them from being used as replacement workers. The article that I'm referring to, and all the notes as usual are up at a PDF at arsenalfordemocracy.com when this episode goes out. The article by two history professors from New York that I'm referring to here mentions that just before the Civil War, an example of a day rate of $3 for non-prison iron workers in New York City compared to 40 cents a day for imprisoned workers there, which I think actually sounds quite similar, unfortunately, to the rates of prison labor in some of the states today without any sort of adjustment for inflation over that period. But it is important, as we alluded to earlier, to emphasize that the prisoners under the contract labor system were not getting the money themselves. Today, they are at least getting some money, though not all the money. But that is, in my opinion, still kind of a fig leaf to be like, see, we stopped doing prison slavery without actually doing it. But this then leads us to the next phase of reforms. In response to the Long Depression, which is the topic that we covered a couple weeks ago on the show, so check that out for more information about the economic conditions then. But there was basically, by the time you get to the, let's say, the 1880s, well, even the 1870s, they start looking into this. But in the 1880s and 1890s, you have a lot of companies who are saying this attempted reform of saying we're going to move all the factories into the prisons and we're going to cut out these outside, you know, abusive labor practices by outside companies, and we're going to just have the prisons run their own factories. These outside private businesses then said, hey, that's not fair. You have a very cheap way of doing this with this essentially slave labor, and we can't compete with that. And so they started putting political pressure to make various changes to deal with this. And this leads to public purchasing requirements, which are also called state use laws. And Kelly's going to talk a little bit in just a few moments about more about that. But public purchasing requirements were created in the late 19th century in New York. This is now going into a JSTOR article that I found from Social Forces, a publication in October 1940. The headline of that was "The State Use System of Prison Labor in Massachusetts." So the public purchasing requirements were created in late 19th century New York to try to carve out a market for products that would no longer be in direct competition with non-prison labor suppliers in the private sector. The AFL, the American Federation of Labor, then promoted similar laws around the country to protect union workers from prison competition. And I've now summarized this as follows. By 1899, 43 of 45 states had adopted some form of state use requirements. So again, there's two phases here. First is saying we need to have totally in-house prison labor production supply chains and everything so that we stop having these abusive outside contracts. And then second is in order to prevent that from competing with those outside companies that that manufacture the same goods, we're going to separate that by saying, by creating a public-facing prison labor thing, meaning public agencies, public governments, things like that, as opposed to the private sector. Although New York had adopted the change first, it followed a first-in-the-nation comprehensive investigation of prison labor practice and potential regulation at the behest of the Massachusetts legislature in 1878. So again, you can see this process starting in 1878 and going until 1899 to try to move this new system of in-house prison labor into a more restricted sphere of operations. However, the recommendations in the Massachusetts report were pretty light, and the report was formulated to suggest that while the number of prison laborers was so minuscule compared to the free labor force, that there was probably not actually a threat of unfair competition, despite the political pressure saying there was, that perhaps there should be some sort of public purchasing system that should be devised, or that prison labor should be tested for public works projects, which is another thing that, unlike in the South, where you had these outdoor chain gangs, in the North, there was a lot more reluctance to have prisoners out working on stuff like infrastructure projects and things because they thought they might escape. But this report suggested, hey, we should test doing that. And this was something that was going around the scene at the time. The recommendations were largely ignored in Massachusetts. used initially until it had caught on elsewhere. And when I say the scene, I should clarify, I mean that people tended to pay attention across state lines and national borders in this time period about trends in and research on prisons at the time. So even though it was ignored in Massachusetts, it was adopted in New York and various other places, and then eventually they did get back to it in Massachusetts. By this point, there was a big push to abolish contract labor completely. Again, that would be when they're contracting them out to private companies, as opposed to just making things and then selling them. And the push was for both economic and moral reasons, given the working conditions. However, the compromise was to preserve prison labor as a thing in-house, but only to supply public agencies and entities, and to start actually paying the prisoners some amount from the proceeds instead of just enslaving them and pocketing all of the money. So now we start to see prisoners actually beginning to get some of the money themselves in some cases. Any surplus beyond public needs, meaning like if the state didn't need as much to buy as much stuff as was being produced by these new prison factory systems, was to be sold to private buyers, but it was to be sold at prevailing wholesale value so as not to undercut the private vendors that weren't using prison labor. Not long after this, state purchasing laws in Massachusetts were extended, this was after they had actually adopted it, were extended to municipalities in order to try to better align the size of the market to the size of the production capacity, which again, keep this in the back of your mind because it's going to come up again when we return to the present day. There is a problem here inherently, which is if you have so many prisoners working that you're overproducing goods, the solution is probably not to try to find new markets for those goods. It's probably to ask why you have so many prisoners in the first place, but that does not appear to have crossed their minds. And so they said, okay, the state's not buying enough, the counties aren't buying enough, so we need to force the municipalities to start buying goods from the prisons in Massachusetts. This system continued with only a few minor changes until federal legislation was passed during the Great Depression after years of effort by Herbert Hoover before he became president. This was one of his hobby horses as Commerce Secretary that he'd worked on for a while. And the new legislation at the federal level made the public focus even stronger by largely banning private sales of prison-produced goods, but also allowing states to set their own regulations on the sale of goods from other states' prisons, which I assume has to do with the fact that some states probably actually did not have enough capacity in their own prisons, if they were a really small state, to be able to produce everything that the state governments needed. And if you had all these requirements saying that the state governments and municipal governments were required by law to buy stuff from the prisons, then you got a bit of a catch-22. So good news, you can now import them across state lines from other prisons in other states. But the other stipulation was that the federal law said that prison-made products had to be labeled as such if they were to be sold across state lines. And also in the 1930s, they created the Public Corporation for Federal Prison Labor, which I don't think had existed before then. And then I'm about to get back to Kelly's research as we get to the 1980s and 1990s. This is an important transition from this period. So in the 1980s, and then especially in the 1990s, the conservative group that we all know and hate, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, exploited some loopholes in a 1979 federal prison labor reform law and proliferated legislation very quickly across state lines to greatly expand prison labor and to move it back into the private sector after a century of more or less a prohibition on that. This was largely to open a new revenue stream for for-profit prison corporations, but was framed as a benefit to the prisoners. Outside contractors would have to pay the workers market rate wages according to the 1979 federal law. But, as Rachel was explaining earlier, under ALEC's state laws implementing this federal system, significant portions of those wages could be diverted to the prison systems, including for-profit prison companies, for charges such as room and board or victim restitution. So they threw in some stuff that would sound good to the public. And then, what I consider to be the most nefarious, towards special accounts that were specifically intended to finance lobbying and corporate recruitment efforts to grow the industry. So they can take part of your paycheck that was, you know, some company paid you paid for your labor as a prisoner. They didn't pay you directly. They paid for your labor at full equitable market rate wages or, you know, minimum wage in your state. And then the, interceding authority, whether it's a state department of corrections or a for-profit prison corporation or whatever is the intermediary, that is facilitating the sale of your labor, takes a significant chunk of that, not only for room and board, basically you have to pay your own way with your meals and your, you know, cell that you're living in, but also putting it into an account that they can use to go to like junkets and say, hey, do you want to buy from prison systems? We've got all this good stuff, which, by the way, I've actually seen that in Massachusetts, like at trade shows and stuff. Like, hey, what's up? It's the corporation that represents the state corporation that represents the prison labor. And do you need to buy stuff? Here's some cheap stuff you can buy for your municipality or whatever. Again, we'll get back into that later. But this is a major source of diversions there. And that was sort of the new trend of the 1990s. So Kelly, can you talk a little bit more about that aspect?
Yeah, absolutely. So besides the fact that the amendment to our Constitution literally allows this, sort of expansions for workers' rights in prisons have been squashed sort of time and time again from the court. One of the more poignant cases that I saw was Harker versus State Use Industries in 1993. And like Bill just articulated, these state use systems are essentially the state's right or the state's access to prison labor for the exclusive purpose of generating products for the state. Until, of course, there are too many products. And then, like Bill said, they go into the wholesale market. But Harker was working for State Use Industries, which is the Maryland corporation of the state use system. And he tried to access the rights which were established under the National Fair Labor Standards for things such as minimum wage. He said, hey, wait a second, I'm working every day, I'm showing up to my job, and I don't have the same rights as other workers in our countries. And so he tried to get those rights. Unfortunately, the courts ruled that essentially the relationship between that of state use industries and the incarcerated folks who work for them is not truly the relationship of an employer and employee. And I think they raised this, they decided this and articulated their decision for a couple reasons, all of which I can see pretty serious flaws with. The first is that they said that the work is for rehabilitation and training purposes. This isn't sort of just like a job for the sake of a job, but really prisoners are getting something out of this by being rehabilitated through work and getting training for new jobs. I'm sure Rachel and Bill have something to say about this as well, but I find that reasoning questionable at best. There doesn't seem to be a lot of effort made by these industries to actually connect people with work outside of the prison. And there seems to be a lot of ways in which prisoners could be rehabilitated that through things like mental health services and assistance with addiction that aren't happening. It really seems like this rehabilitation for prisoners in many ways, like the state only uses that as a defense for their labor. Another reason that the court stated was that incarcerated laborers do not have the free will to choose their employment. Because they're involuntarily incarcerated, the Department of Correction wields virtually absolute control over them to a degree simply not found in the free labor situation of true employment, the judge said. And finally, the judge said there's no minimum wage necessary for living since all needs are taken care of. You know, the idea of a minimum wage, ideally, although we know it's not even like this outside of the prison system, is that you would be able to pay for food and shelter and for taking care of your family with a minimum wage. But since their prisoners' food and shelter is provided for, there's no reason for them to access any sort of minimum wage. And this sort of opinion that the relationship between a prisoner and the state youth system is not one of employee and employer, affects not only the prisoner's right to a minimum wage and some sort of dignity in their work, but the Brennan Center also notes that even worse, prisoners are excluded from the U.S. Occupational Health and Safety Administration protections that require employers to provide a safe working environment. This dehumanizing lack of protection for prison workers has long subjected them to conditions that have endangered their physical safety. In other words, not only are they not getting minimum wage, but they can also be working in conditions that are far more dangerous than you would see outside of the prison system, simply because this relationship as an employee and employer are not recognized, and therefore employers such as the state use industries are not required to follow the law set forth by the U.S. Occupational Health and Safety Administration. I knew about the 13th Amendment prior to researching this episode. I didn't realize how many times this had been upheld in the courts as workers fought to sort of advance their rights and the rights of other inmates. And I think this lack of acknowledgement that this is an employee-employer relationship really seems to be at a lot of the court decisions. I guess I don't really want to use the word surprise, but I'm disappointed that we haven't been able to poke more holes in that argument, because it seems pretty obvious to me that the only reason that state use industries is in prisons at all is for the labor, and to not recognize that labor presents a lot of challenges in the court system.
And this does affect all of us. I mean, this should have some sort of effect on your conscience regardless, I think, but it does actually affect all of us because, for example, if you don't have OSHA protections and a pandemic hits and you happen to have prison labor working in meatpacking factory work, I think I can see a connection there. Not that the people in the meatpacking factories that aren't prison laborers are particularly protected right now either. They keep on getting the coronavirus and still being forced to work. So anyway, I don't want to get off topic on that, but it is worth mentioning that particular connection. I'm so frustrated, though, by the line that you just talked about, Kelly, in that decision in 1993 in the Harker v. State Use Industries case in Maryland. That line, while incarcerated inmates have no such need because the DOC provides them with the food, shelter, and clothing that employees would have to purchase, in a true employment situation. So long as DOC provides for these needs, Harker can have no credible claim that inmates need a minimum wage to ensure their welfare and standard living. Okay, this is so absurd on its face. If you know even anything at all about the way that prisons are run these days, even in the totally not for-profit prisons that are just run by the states directly and all that, they're still doing all kinds of things like charging people to call their relatives. They're still charging them for any form of entertainment at this point. Anything that they can nickel and dime them for, they're doing that. And the other thing is, even if you're in prison, you may still have expenses on the outside, right? Unless you are just by yourself, totally alone in the world, you probably have relatives to take care of. You maybe have rent payments to help out with your family that's on the outside. You maybe have a kid that's, you know, got to put through school. There's any number of costs and expenses. And even if you didn't have that, you should be able to collect money during this time period so that you have savings when you get out. This is so absurd. And they just don't care. They just don't care. They're like, these are not people, basically. And I think that even if you were really persnickety about, well, the 13th Amendment says we can do this, that is not a reasonable way of interpreting things. That's also an optional way of interpreting things.
I was just going to add to that. I mean, if you think about what this system could be, if somebody was able to earn real money, at least minimum wage money while they were in prison, and were able to use that money to help for childcare for a child outside of the prison or a parent outside of the prison, you just imagine that those relationships would be sort of that much stronger when somebody left prison, or if they were able to have enough for a down payment for an apartment or something when they left prison. The recidivism rate in this country is ridiculous, and it's because we don't help with that transition between prison and, you know, after prison. And so I think that sort of rethinking this and allowing people to really have the dignity of earning a minimum wage while incarcerated could have a huge effect in people's ability to re-enter society. And it just seems like a huge missed opportunity, as well as just something that should weigh on all of our moral consciences.
Let's talk now about the situation in California this year, because I think that also underscores the OSHA point. So one of the most common arguments employed even to present day in defense of this system and saying that it's okay to not pay them and this is good to make these people work, well, you know, it's voluntary and they're building skills, right? That's the argument. They say they're volunteering to do this and they're developing skills that they'll be able to put to use in the workforce after they leave, and this is great. You know, it's helping to rehabilitate them. It's going to reduce recidivism. That is total BS in most cases. Okay, so let's talk about the extreme example here that highlights all of the problems we've talked about all in one, and it is the most 2020 news story there is out of the United States. Okay. Headline from Fortune magazine, July 15th, 2020, this year, California is facing a wildfire fighter shortage because prisoners are getting sick with COVID. This is going to bring together all these themes we've been talking about. So here's some sections I'm going to rattle off from this article quickly, and I think you'll get what's going on here. The California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection has responded to nearly 4,000 wildfires, ravaging 34,000 acres in the first 7 months of 2020, up from 2,800 over the same period a year ago. And those numbers are just going to keep going up. To help fight these fires, the state typically depends on about 2,200 incarcerated people to work the front lines, but state prison officials have announced that at least 30 of the state's 77 inmate crews are now under lockdown due to outbreaks of the coronavirus in their camps. The news comes as cases of the virus surge all over California, especially in prison systems, where inmates report a lack of basic access to sanitation products like hand sanitizer or the ability to social distance. CDCR currently has over 6,600 confirmed COVID-19 cases. The California Correctional Center, which is the primary training hub for incarcerated wildland firefighters, has seen the second largest spike in cases, with 216 in the last 2 weeks. California Governor Gavin Newsom also noted that a decrease in prison population in total has severely limited fire crews. Even before the virus spread, 13 crews had been lost due to natural attrition, expedited releases, and sentencing reform changes, said CDCR Information Officer Aaron Francis. The state has released about 10,000 inmates early to avoid crowding because of the pandemic, and another 8,000 could be released by August. Inmates typically fight fires for wages between $2.90 and $5.12 per day, plus an additional $1 per hour during active emergencies for potentially life-threatening efforts. The firefighters they work alongside, meaning the non-prison firefighters, earn an average of $91,000 each year before overtime pay and bonuses. Cal Fire has around 6,500 year-round employees and around 9,000 during fire seasons. Inmates, which make up hand crews, which is like digging firebreak trenches and things like that, represent a very significant portion of that staff. The Conservation Camp Program, officially established in 1945, is estimated to save California taxpayers about $100 million each year. During active fires, inmates earn about $27 each day, much better than other prison jobs that would earn them 8 cents to 37 cents per hour. They also have fresher food, more freedom, and perhaps more importantly, receive 2 days off their prison sentence for every 1 day served, commonly known as 2-for-1. The prisoners who work at fire camps often find that they're unable to put their skills to use when they're released. The majority of firefighting jobs in the U.S. and most of the 900 fire departments in California require employees to obtain an emergency medical technician or paramedic license, and in California, the majority of convicted felons can't obtain those licenses until they've been out of prison for 10 years. We live in hell. They've created hell on earth. And also, you can go on and on all you want about, oh, the real problem is for-profit prisons and we've got to stop the for-profit prison lobby. I'm sorry, $100 million a year in savings to the state government from this state program? Yeah, I think I can see why they're using this and exploiting this huge loophole, even though that's not a private sector thing. That's just the state trying to cash in and turn their prison force into money. It's completely ridiculous. Anyway, there was also an article in Time Magazine, November of 2018, headline, Inmates Fighting California Wildfires Are More Likely to Get Hurt, Records Show. More than 1,000 inmate firefighters required hospital care between June 2013 and August 2018, according to data obtained by Time through FOIA requests. They're more than four times as likely per capita to incur object-induced injuries, such as cuts, bruises, dislocations, and fractures, compared with professional firefighters working on the same fires. Inmates were also more than eight times as likely to be injured after inhaling smoke and particulates compared with other firefighters. And I'm not going to read all the rest of this. You can look in the notes at arsenalfordemocracy.com. But these so-called conservation camps, as they euphemistically term them, have been established on a temporary basis as of 1915, then a permanent basis in 1946, and they've had women doing it since 1986. And again, there are thousands of people that are working on these. And I think it's absurd to look at what I've just said and say that these people definitely have a meaningful choice in this and that they're just, you know, volunteering for it. And it's totally, there's no incentives that are really pressuring them to do this. Very dangerous job where they're not given any of the same pay or protections as anyone else and can't use that skill after they get out.
I mean, I think that I'm having a hard time thinking of like anything else to say besides sort of basically the headline of that article, that it's just so, so horrific. And I'm thinking specifically about how hard and rightfully so, how difficult it is to get permission to do research on folks in prison, because even if you say there's no pressure to get involved, like when people have been stripped of their free will and freedom by design, how can they make their own choices about, you know, participate, electing to be in a research study? And it just seems like that I'm very comfortable with how high that bar is for research, but it seems as if almost the exact opposite sort of thought process occurs when you're talking about work, that people think all of a sudden that incarcerated folks have total free will as whether or not to participate in a job, and that they're making totally rational decisions to get, you know, work for 30 cents a day or an hour or whatever it may be. And I think it's just because of the money involved in the savings to the state itself, let alone any sort of third party that may be making money off it as well.
Another thing I wanted to highlight is, back in May, New Orleans sanitation workers went on strike due to their working conditions during the pandemic, and the city fired them, or I guess the city contracted through a staffing service to hire these sanitation workers, and the staffing agency fired the workers and then filled in these vacancies with prison labor from a private company called Lock 5 LLC. And whereas the original contract with these sanitation workers, they were getting paid $10.25 an hour, the inmate laborers were going to only get paid $9.25 an hour. However, it wasn't even the city that removed the prison laborers, basically scab laborers. The staffing agency and Lock 5 actually removed the workers because they didn't want to get in the middle of a labor dispute. So that's another big aspect of this, is how prison labor is used to undermine worker actions, trying to get better conditions, working conditions, better pay, hazard pay. And it's kind of interesting to see that the actual staffing company that places the prisoners in these positions didn't want to get in the middle of that labor dispute. The city seemed to be gung-ho on replacing the original laborers with scab laborers.
All right, so a few more brief statistics from when I was looking up the situation in Massachusetts, which is the one that I know, you know, have more close familiarity with. So in Massachusetts, they call it Mass Corps. That's, a public corporation, a state-owned corporation. There's about 500 of these prisoner laborers. Under state law, under the state use laws, which is the term we talked about earlier, Massachusetts agencies, departments, cities, towns, and municipalities are exempt from any obligation to participate in the usual bidding procedures on any purchase of any size. So if you look in their catalog, you can see that they've literally supplied the desks of some of the town councils and so forth across the state. And I know like business cards in the state legislature are printed with prison labor and so forth. But additionally, municipalities are not only incentivized by this exemption, but also my understanding, this may be incorrect, but my understanding of what I've been told as a city official, as a city councilor, is that if there is a bidding process, they basically are going to go with, they have to go with the cheaper one by law, which is generally going to be the prison production. The wages in Massachusetts that are actually go to the prisoners range between 85 cents and $1.45 an hour. That's pretty impressive compared to the rest of the country, which is horrifying to me and remains something that's been viscerally eating away at me since I think 2015 when I noticed this, specifically about the Massachusetts pay scale. And around the country, according to one source that I looked at on this, wages for inmates in those similar state-owned businesses for prison labor averaged between 33 cents an hour and 141 per hour, according to Prison Policy Initiative data. There was a recent story there was a student journalist broke the story out in Western Massachusetts about how his high school auditorium, the seats were being reupholstered with prison labor. And that was, you know, morally reprehensible, I think. I believe that's my opinion. I guess I don't know why I'm classifying it that way or like qualifying it. But anyway, I believe it's morally reprehensible in general. And it seemed like they did too. But the big twist on that was that they compared to see in the bidding process, because there was a bidding process, who were the two bids that were put in? You know, who could they have chosen instead of going with the prison labor? Again, setting aside this question of whether or not by law they're allowed to choose somebody else. But let's just say, for the purposes of this, that they could have. The alternative bid came from something called Wellspring Cooperative, which was a local organization that hires formerly incarcerated people and compensates them up to $25 an hour and makes them worker owners of the business. So the town literally went with prison labor for this, you know, pennies on the hour, or maybe a dollar or so on the hour, depending. Compared to a $25 an hour pay worker co-op of formerly incarcerated people. That's what we're up against. And my closing on this is to think about the material dimensions of this and figure out what we can do. I mean, I personally am more in the camp of like, we need to totally rethink all sort of incarcerative processes and rehabilitation and all of that, and go in a completely new direction. But if we're thinking about what reforms need to happen in the meantime, we need to attack the material incentives that are pushing us in this direction, right? Because there have been periods in the United States of various attempted reforms, and some of them have gone in the complete wrong direction in terms of incentivizing this rather than disincentivizing this process. If we're going to do a reform, we need to do a reform that actually gets us closer down the road toward eliminating this abusive prison labor process and doing something else completely with imprisonment and rehabilitation in general. Guaranteeing wage equity, genuine wage equity to prisoners, to prisoner laborers, is a reform that I believe would get us further down the road toward abolition or whatever you want to call it. by significantly undermining capitalist incentives toward expanding the population of prisoner laborers. It is imperative that any prison labor programs pay equitable wages because of the exorbitant cost of many prison services, like we mentioned about contact with outside friends and family and basic entertainment and snacks and things like that. And an additional crucial reform is that the laws must be revised to ensure that any so-called skills development among prisoner laborers is not completely useless once they're released because of convicts being barred from or severely discouraged from obtaining that kind of work. I think that ultimately we need a total rethink on prison as a whole, but I think that in the meantime, if we don't get down, if we don't completely redo the prison labor process, there's just going to be a continued incentive by both public corporations and private corporations to exploit these prisons for profit centers and therefore bring in more prisoners in order to feed that machine. That's where I'm at on that. Rachel, thank you so much for being on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
And Kelly, thank you for being on as well.
Thanks for having me.